Thanks for tuning in to WMPG. I'm your host, Tosh, and today we're interviewing some members of the Faculty and Staff of Color Association to learn about why it was created and the community they've built with it.
Alrighty, just started recording. So why don't you guys start off by introducing yourselves?
My name is Michelle Vasquez Jacobus. I am an associate professor of sociology, or rather I'm an associate professor in the sociology department, but I am not a sociologist. I have been at USM for 21 years this coming summer. And my educational background, my academic background is I'm trained as a lawyer and as a social worker. And I do a great deal of my work, my scholarship on community engagement and promoting racial and ethnic diversity in Maine. And I am a proud member of the Faculty and Staff of Color Association for 3.5 years now or so.
Awesome. And Kiva?
My name is Kiva Wright-Berry. I am the senior finance business partner for finance and administration, focusing mostly on academic affairs. I've been at USM since 2004, and so I deal with primarily the finances of the academic affairs portion of the university, but right now I'm dealing with everything because we're short-staffed, as usual. So, I've been here since 2004. My background is in music, and I've never worked in music, but yeah, that's what my background is in music and education.
Righty. And Larissa?
Hi, so I'm Larissa Malone. I am in the teacher education department, currently serving as the chair of the department. I've been at USM, this is my third year. So I have been blessed in that when I came to USM, the Faculty and Staff of Color Association had already been founded. So I don't know anything different. So that's just wonderful. And my background is in teaching. So I taught early preschool and early elementary in Montessori for years. And then I was an administrator at a bilingual community center that partnered with public schools. And I was just fascinated in the way that society and school interacted along the lines of race many times, often. And so that became my focus. And so I went back to school and got my degree in cultural foundations of education and have been in higher education ever since.
Yeah, my name's Keith Danner. I'm a counselor here at the school in the counseling department. I did both my undergrad and grad school at USM.
Why did you guys choose to work at USM?
Well, I came here as a trailing spouse. My husband came here to be the provost of the University of New England. And he's now since retired from that, but that's why we came. And I found something here. But I've been in higher ed almost my entire career.
I'd love to hear the answer to that question from Larissa, if we could, because I'm always curious about that with newer faculty too.
Yeah, that's interesting. When I was on a job search, I came to Maine to interview. Not that I had any interest in Maine. I had never even been to Maine before. And my department did a really good job of tailoring the interview to me and my interest. So they took me to Portland Public Schools. They introduced me to the first administrator, principal of Muslim descent. They took me to the library that hosts the Talbot African American collection in for the state of Maine. So they really showed me that I could live here and thrive here. And I think outside of Maine is known as the whitest state, right? And albeit that's true, we exist here. And we've always existed here, and they did a really good job of laying the groundwork for that. So I came with just like, oh, I'll get an interview under my belt. And then I left really wanting the position, and just intrigued with working at a regional comprehensive university, because there's such close ties between the university and the public sphere. So, yeah.
Recognizing that we are doing this interview on recording, do you feel like that was an accurate representation of what you were going to be coming into, in that they showed you the most racially and ethnically diverse parts of Maine and of Portland?
I do. I do think it was accurate. I mean, it certainly wasn't like portrayed as these are the only things that exist. And, you know, so I was just impressed that they, number one, showed that I had a future here, like my research could continue because most of my research is focused on racial justice, and that me coming wasn't an anomaly, right? Others had come before me of diverse backgrounds and ethnicities. So that was very important for me to see. So yeah, I didn't feel hoodwinked at all. So
that's what I was asking.
Yes,
that's where I was going.
Can you guys explain what the FSOCA is and explain what it means to you?
Go on, Michelle.
All right, I'll take a stab. USM has had different kinds of diversity committees for as long as I've been here, and in many cases they have been formed by or organized by the president or the administration, by leadership, to serve in a quasi advisory role, so not even a true advisory role, and not had a lot of genuine function. I have often felt like sometimes those diversity groups were used as a mechanism for the university being able to say we're doing something about diversity. Maine is the whitest state. It's been the whitest state as long as I've lived here. These two points are going to connect in a second. And I think the Faculty and Staff of Color Association was started by a few members, about 5 years ago, very informally, as a chance for faculty and staff of color to gather together, to advocate for each other, and to provide ourselves a sense of home and belonging. And in Maine, realistically, we couldn't have a Latinx faculty association, for instance. There'd be two people on it, an African American faculty association, something, or a faculty and staff association, even something similar. So pretty early on, I think many of us who identify as people of color recognized that we can find belonging community with each other if we are sort of, we extend to people who self-identify as people of color at the university. So that's why the Faculty and Staff of Color Association, I think for us to find belonging and community and home.
And I'll just add to what's been said. So this organization, as it currently stands, is new. But as Michelle mentioned, there has been efforts in the past. In fact, there were efforts when I first arrived. We had a couple of meetings of people of color, that tribe, and we tried to get something off the ground. And it just never stuck for a variety of reasons. One, people kept leaving, but that made it difficult. So in recent years, I think there's been more opportunities because there've been more people to be here, to be in the group. And so I think we've made a concerted effort to make it a real group and not just a happenstance kind of organization. And so I think it's very important for others to come here and to be able to find a community within the community of USM. And I think this will help, our organization will help to solidify that so that we stop losing people simply because they feel totally unwelcomed or just so isolated.
Yeah, I just want to add to that is that the political landscape also changed. You know what I mean? In 2016 with Trump and, you know, Trumpism and, you know, and George Floyd and, like, you know what I mean? A lot of things have changed that helped galvanize us, that kind of put the urgency, you know, and the importance of us being together.
What do you think makes the difference between the FSOCA, like, now versus previous attempts?
I can take that. And then I think, Kiva, you probably have enough history with these groups to know. Well, first of all, we were not formed by the administration. We're nobody's token now. And this kind of goes hand in hand. We also don't have the level of support, resource support, that maybe we did when we were somebody's token. We have to fight for everything we get, for our budget, for allowances for our co-leaders, who are now Larissa and Keith. But I feel like we have real genuine purpose and that we get stuff done. Like hearing that from Larissa that she doesn't know before the FSOCA is really kind of gave me the chills, because, you know, that's even that you can even identify that that's a thing. And when Dr. Idella Glenn came, after she was given the offer and before she started work, she had a meeting with the FSOCA. If I remember correctly, she asked for it. She asked for a meeting with the FSOCA. And this is in the midst of COVID. So she's not, I think she had flown out here once, but like hadn't met people in person very much. And we asked her really candid questions. I remember asking her, how are you going to find home here? How are you going to find community here? Because the retention rate for faculty and staff of color at all of the higher education institutions in Maine is much lower than it is for faculty and staff of color who identify as white. And she taught, and we made that point to her, you know, how you need to find home, you need to find community. How are you going to do it? And she talked right away. She said, is there a Black church? And people in the group had responses for her. And she was asking the questions that she needed to ask about where she was going to live and find home and find community. And I think we're not responsible for her accepting the offer, you know, but she's an active member of a Faculty and Staff of Color Association. And I think maybe we do something, at least for me, I can say without the FSOCA, I would not be as content. I don't think I'd feel as much purpose. I can't say I would have left, but I've thought about it a few times. And this is a big factor in keeping me here.
The difference is that before we have structure, not tight structure, I don't think. I think it's fluid enough to allow for change. But before we're relying on maybe one person really to try to pull us together. And then they, of course, had other responsibilities where we recognize that it's too much for one person to do. So we try to do it as a group. That's why we have a leadership group as opposed to just, you know, one or two people or one person. So I think it's different. And of course, again, as you know, as Keith mentioned, the climate is different. And I think our mindset is different with those new people coming in, wanting to see this as a real entity.
And I would add that, you know, having a sense of belonging, that's become such a buzzword, you know, every place, but especially in higher education. And how can we create a sense of belonging? And do people feel like they belong? But within that, often overlooked in the mainstream conversation about belonging is how identity plays a role in that. And if you can't see yourself in the group that is being formed, and you may not identify in the same way, or a certain identity marker is important to you and not important to the group, then there's no chance of having a sense of belonging, right? And I think that's what FSOCA fills for a lot of people, because there's a commonality of the importance of race being that identity marker that is often overlooked in the larger mainstream group and a lot of times. So
every time I mention that I'm a member of the FSOCA to folks outside the FSOCA, like last Thursday, we had a critical race theory panel that was organized by members of the FSOCA. I always say I'm a proud member. I didn't ever say I was a proud member of IDEC. I didn't ever say I was a proud member of the President's Council on Diversity. It's an identity that I feel honor in belonging. And it's a very different feeling. And I think if others feel that way, it means a lot to our place in the community.
I definitely feel that way.
And I would say even at the extent of how, like I think it was Michelle mentioned before, it's kind of amazing how we get things done, right? So just recently, we issued a statement on the earthquake and the humanity emergency in Turkey and Syria. And it was such a grassroots movement within FSOCA. There was a member that wanted to, issue a statement. There was probably six or seven members that chimed in to help craft that statement. We got that statement out. We're collecting donations. And in many ways, that represents the university well, right? But it wasn't asked of us to do it. It was just upon some of the members' hearts, and we all rallied together and supported that member's initiative to do that. And so it's amazing that that happened. You know, there's no compensation for that. There's no, incentive for that, except, really caring for causes that matter to people of color, especially. So, yeah.
Just wanted to throw this out there is that when I was going, I was more of a non-traditional student. And I remember I used to get flyers of wanting to get involved, trying to have me get involved with student groups of color, and I was so busy with my stuff, And, it's not that it wasn't important to me. I didn't put a priority on it. So when this opportunity came up, it was like, yes, I need to do this, and I've been here, part of the group since we became a little bit more formal, and a proud member, and it's important to me. And I put it as a priority now.
What does your guys' day-to-day look like?
In the counseling department, we see students, we're available for crisis, we do a counselor of the day, we rotate, we hold workshops, and we're there essentially for students, to support their mental health, we collaborate with different groups. We just had an event the same day as the critical race theory with, we collaborated with Art of Awareness, and we did on Black mental health, and it was amazing, So, yeah, so those are some of the things that we do. Yeah.
A typical day that, that's a tricky question because every day is a little different, I think, in the life of a professor, right? As a professor, it's a teaching institution, so a lot of it is teaching. I'm involved also in administration as the chair, also do research, and also do a lot of service in the community as well. Yeah, it's a very varied day, and it varies day to day. So I start off the day pretty early. I'm an early riser, and I prioritize my day and see what I have to do. Students, the motto for USM is students first. So I try to make sure that I get those tasks taken care of that involve students' progress and schooling. But also there's many other things that I do as well. So I'm working on a couple of different research projects right now. Yeah, I spend a lot of time looking at a screen. So I think everyone on the screen is can attest to the same thing. But yeah, it's all in the service of, you know, progressing the agenda of, you know, students first and moving towards justice, because I feel like that's my driver more than anything. So
I don't think my day is typical. I have a number of people that I have to serve directly as their financial manager. But so I spend a lot of time doing a lot of routine work, approvals and such for spending, associated with spending. But right now we're in the throes of budget development for fiscal year 24. And that is taking up a lot of time. As I said earlier, you know, we're short-staffed and everyone's juggling and doing multiple things that are a little bit out of their job description. But that's taken up a lot of my time. I'm always in meetings, it seems, at least now, until we get the budget settled and ready to go. And then we'll start again. So we're always in budget mode, it seems, because we'll start FY25 preparation over the summer. But right now we have actually put nuts and bolts down for fiscal year 24. So my day just goes along. I do a lot of projects, and so it's a lot of hands-on work. And so I try to get as much of that done. I'm not an early riser, but you could find me here late in the day doing a lot of that work.
So earlier we were talking about how the FSOCA had like previous attempts and whatnot. And how do you think the university is helping to better support you guys and less using you guys as like a token?
So I feel like someone who's been here longer than me should answer this question, but I'll just chime in that something that I've seen since I've been here is the same year that I started was also the year that the Dr. Idella Glenn started, which is the Equity, Inclusion, and Community Impact Department office. So I feel that as part of, you know, administration, we have an ear. And we are being listened to because that office coexists, you know, alongside the timing of when FSOCA began as well. So
I think the former president was supportive overall. And the current president is also supportive overall. The issue, or one issue for us, is that support at any university usually comes with funding. And we don't have that. And from the budget side, we're not in a position to provide that, which is even sadder. So I think that's one of the things that we would be able to help, because we're putting in our own resources to do the things that we want to do, which is not necessarily a bad thing. But since it's not equal, we're not evenly yoked with other organizations that are part of the university. So that would be very helpful for us. So while I don't think they've been unsupportive, I think support could be increased on many levels.
So this is a tough question to answer. And we've had a lot of discussions about this. And stop me if I repeat anything that others have said. We have made appeals for support with the previous president and the current one. And one of the challenges with getting more support is that we can then become an instrument of the administration. And there haven't been a lot of times, but there were some times in the past where we wanted to make statements on controversial issues that the previous president would rather we not make. And if we are supported as a limb of the administration, then that's harder to do. So we have a level of independence that we might compromise if we got more direct support. On the other hand, we do work that is mission critical for the university that we do not get compensation or support for at all. I think if we could take some objective data, we would find that for our membership, we make a difference in terms of retention. I don't know about promotion, but certainly support. I know of a few examples of our members who have gone up for achieved or soon to go up for tenure that have looked to the camaraderie and mentorship of our membership to move forward. I think our group kept us, many of us, buoyed, if not anchored during COVID. We organized the critical race theory conference or summit last week, the conversation. Members, I say we, I was, did not organize it, but others of us did, which is critical to the university. And I think a lot more support would help us do more. And I think there are ways that aren't even that creative that we should be able to get greater support and not have that compromise our independence. And one of the arguments that's been made, including by Dr. Idella Glenn, is that if our group is supported as a quote unquote affiliate, is that the term they use for us? Group of affiliation, association, one of those kinds of words.
Employee resource group.
Yeah.
Affinity.
Affinity. Thank you, Keith. That's what I was going for. If we are supported as an affinity group, then every other affinity group needs to be equally supported. And there is a compelling sort of fairness and justice idea about that, except I would say that one of the principal reasons we formed and why we should be supported is that there is dramatic underrepresentation of people of color in the state of Maine, in the university, and in leadership in university, and our retention rates are lower. If that is true of other quote unquote affinity groups, then maybe their work is also mission critical to the extent that they are able to counterbalance that. And we play a role, faculty and staff of color, in whether students of color come to the university and stay at the university. And that can be said of a lot of different affinity groups, but we do work related to these issues. And so I think that it's not the same to say that we are like all the other affinity groups.
What is your why for working at USM?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I have to answer it in a different way. And my answer is more like, what is my why, period? And my why is to help ensure that all children receive access and opportunity for education, right? And the focus on Black students in particular. So that is my driver for everything I do. And that transcends my place of employment that traveled with me from, you know, my previous institution. And even when I was in grad school, that's been my purpose. So I think that I'm grateful that I have the opportunity to continue with my personal mission in Maine, at the University of Southern Maine. But like I said, it transcends like my place of employment. It's a personal and calling that I have.
You know, I could say the why for me is, you know, it's almost like a ripple effect. You know, I can't say it, you know, the students are the future leaders of society, you know, and just to, you know, just my role as a counselor to help someone with their mental health, you know, and to gain more insight, they may pass that forward and help someone else, or may be inspired to go into the field, or maybe can understand the, you know, importance of mental health. That's the same thing with DEIA, you know, concerns, you know, that the work that we do influences people and they can see how important it is and how valuable it is, you know, for society in general. You know what I mean? And that hopefully can ripple effect, you know, in their homes, in their communities, or in their work, you know? So that's kind of the way I look at it, the why I do it, you know, is very passionate because I feel that, you know, it's not just, I mean, I came in, it's more to, you know, to spread. It's not just one, you know, event or incident, you know what I mean, in a vacuum, you know what I mean, is to, you know, to spread out.
At the end of the day, what puts a smile on your guys' face?
I learned in one of those Myers-Briggs tests that I'm problems, not problem solver, but I'm a fixer also. And so when I can get through the day and I have done what I came in to do, then I'm good. So I can go home and I don't have to keep doing the work. But I like to start and end projects, even if they're long term. And so that's what makes me happy. It has nothing to do with necessarily USM. This is how I live my life, trying to complete things and get things done, or to problem solve if I can. So that's pretty much it.
So Kiva, do you think being a member of FSOCA brings more problems to your attention that you have to fix, or does it enable you to fix problems? And I know those aren't mutually exclusive.
Now, I don't think it brings more problems. I mean, my involvement with FSOCA is that it's, as we say in our mission statement, it provides a safe place. I mean, that was one of the things 3 years ago, shortly after George Floyd's murder, that, you know, I brought to the group, that it was, you know, that things have been said in the meeting. And I just thought, how can you say things like that when someone has just been brutally beaten to death or held down and suffocated? So I look for that kind of community. So I don't think there are any problems that FSOCA could bring me that would compound my life, because it's going to add value to it.
And so maybe provides a venue for some of that fixing you like to do?
I don't know.
That's a stretch.
Yeah. Some of, I can't be fixing all the time. So sometimes it's good just to be. And that does allow me just to be, because I don't have to put on any type of mask and pretend that I like what you're saying and that you understand who I am. I'm not worried if you're wondering why my hair was curly and it wasn't curly. Yes, I'm not worried about all those things in that group. So, and you need that. You need those kind. I think you need those kinds of outlets in order to get through the course of the days.
Absolutely. I think what Kiva just said also relates to what puts a smile on my face. I've been here long enough at USM that I get kind of cynical sometimes about whether I am personally achieving the purpose that I think I should be doing. And it's fun for me to learn from other people. It's fun for me to be able to relax and just interact with smart, impassioned, engaged people. And even though I hate Zoom, like even doing this is fun. Last week when we had that CRT summit, I was reminded why I'm a teacher and why I'm a teacher at USM. And I learned so much, and there was real positive energy. And I felt, I don't often feel at USM recently like I belong in the classroom anymore, like I can be effective or like I have something to add. And I felt good at what I was doing. And I felt real excited to be with the people I was with. And when Keith walked in and was standing in the back of the room, and Keith was a student in a class of mine, what, 15 years ago? I almost started crying, because that hits, but like good crying, because that hits a connection in me about sort of the cycle and the purpose that we're in this together. And that puts a big smile on my face.
Yeah, I would add that there is such a deep sense of admiration for each other, I think, within FSOCA. It's so much more than just advocacy or being social or working towards a cause. It's all of those things, right, that really draw us together and support each other and really have a sense of pride, I think, towards each other. So I was minimally involved in that statement regarding Turkey and Syria. But I admired everyone who pitched in and, you know, really drove that, right? And just had so much passion and had done so much research. And, you know, so, and like I said at the panel last week, you know, I looked at Michelle with admiration, just hearing her responses, you know, and anything that we have any questions about finances or what we can do, we can turn to Kiva right away. So And you know, anything that if we want to know the pulse of what's going on with students, we have insight from Keith in his office, right? So I just think there's, you know, a lot of respect and admiration that is plentiful in FSOCA that really feeds, like I said, not just our professional lives, but our personal lives and spiritual lives as well. So
you mentioned the evening of the CRT, and then right after that, the Art of Awareness. That was a long day for me, but it did not feel long. You know what I mean? Because I when I got there, and I, you know, it was just unbelievable events. And I ran to a former student was in the back, and we were sitting there talking and just taking it all in. And you know, that's what brings, you know, just to be able to connect with folks. And just going back to Michelle, you know, you're talking about 15 plus years ago, that inspired me. That's that ripple effect. You know what I mean? That the connection I had with you back then, you know what I mean? And along the way, that's why I'm trying to, you know, try to pass forward. You know what I mean? And so what happened is, you know, it was just unbelievable. And that's what brings a smile to my face.
Something I keep writing a note to myself to bring up, and I think what the things we just shared added a lot to that. There's definitely a sum is greater than the parts to our group. And that balance, we were co-writing an essay, basically, with what Larissa is describing. And we are collaboratively led. That's really rare. I've tried to do some research into collaboratively led organizations, and you have co-chairs and that kind of thing. And we do have co-chairs. But we are a collaboratively led organization, and that is very, very rare. And to be able to be collaboratively led, and we're not just a social organization, and move things forward, I think it really, the model of how we interact is really innovative. And there's a term I'm looking for, I can't find. It parallels our values. I think we try to avoid, we're the faculty and staff of Color Association. We're not the faculty association, we're not the staff association. And we wrestle with that. You know, we don't want to have distinctions. We don't want to have hierarchy and hegemony in our group. And so to be collaboratively led and to bring in all this expertise and meet each other at the same level is truly unique. It shouldn't be, but it is, especially in academia.
Yeah, I was going to say the fact that we're faculty and staff, I think makes a difference. I mean, higher ed does not work that way. In general, it's you know, it's separate. There's separate groups. All the other entities at USM, I think, are separate groups. And I think we're making a concerted effort that we have both faculty and staff leading our events, or where it's more, where it makes more sense for one or the other, and we're fine with that as well. But I think because as a whole, groups of color are people of color marginalized, we can't add that to our own group and decide that we're going to marginalize one particular entity over another. And we can't do that. So I think that helps. Knowing that internally, I think helps the way we're trying to govern ourselves. As I said, it's loose. It might not be what other people want, but right now it is working for us. And when it doesn't work, I think we're going to be nimble enough to say, oh, let's try something different.
And I like to say that we're all leaders. You know what I mean? Like when I, you know, saying thank you for your leadership, I mean, we're all leaders and we all bring stuff to the table. So that's amazing.
What does Black History Month mean to you guys?
Well, so for me, it's a bit of a mix because I'm old enough to remember when it was called Negro History Week. So we've moved, fortunately, we moved beyond that. But even still, you know, I think for many African Americans, it's every month. I mean, I'm learning every month. And really, one of my concerns was that, you know, is the same information still being taught and raised up as when I learned, you know, many, many years ago? You know, there's not a handful of Black folks who have done something. there's a wealth. So why can't we learn about the wealth of them? You can highlight people, of course, but it makes it, by relegating it to a month, it makes it sound as though this is the only time we can talk about it. I mean, you look on TV, every Black movie that ever was made is on TV. And it's like, really? This is the only time you can show these things? You know, all the commercials got Black people in them. I mean, really? It frustrates me so much that we think we have to relegate any group to a specific time when life goes on every day. So I wish we could overcome that kind of stigma of saying this is Black History Month. Next month is Women's History Month. So we'll only talk about women next month. So it's just so silly to me.
Yeah, I'm with Kiva on that. It's a very mixed bag for me. I've been struck by the notion that I kind of think that Black History Month is for white people because people of color celebrate us all year. And if it's not mainstream, we're always tuning into the movies that we can identify with all year round, right? And, you know, being part of, you know, the education community, what I was struck by last week was just the number of questions we were getting about how to teach Black history, right? And I'm glad that was an inquiry by education students. However, I also was just struck that it's February. You've been in education for, I don't know, at least since August, if you started this year. What is it that you don't feel comfortable or know the answer to that question already? And it's been like 6 or 7 months. And how come this is not being modeled in the class that you're placed in for internship? So I felt like, yes, glad you asked the question, but also I would hope that you would have some answers or seeing it modeled in the school that you're placed at. And if you're not, then what is Black History Month even for, right? And there was a lot of questions along the side of how are the people going to respond to Black history, whether it be parents or teachers or students. And it's just, I think it's really important to reframe and redefine what history is, right? Because anything that's not Black history or what is typically taught is called white history. And we give it the privilege of just calling it history and chopping off the white part of it. And if we framed it like that, then I think that would challenge us in a new way and really help us dissect the importance or the necessity or even the inclusion of Black history, period. So
the one thing that, you know, I feel the same way you guys feel, you know, as far as the month, you know, the focus on the month. The one thing that, you know, that you never know what's going to be, you know, revealed, you know what I mean? In general, when you dig deeper, you know, how history is written by the victors, you know, so to speak. And, you know, I remember the movie Something the Lord Made, you know, with Mos Def, and, you know, as far as the open heart surgery and the stents and, you know what I mean? And, you know, these are things, stories that were kind of buried that no one knew about, you know what I mean? So the more those stories come out, you know, folks would see the integral part that we've played in the world, you know what I mean? That, you know, that is never really acknowledged, appreciated. You know, it's almost like afraid that, hey, if we acknowledge this, that, you know, we're gonna, you know, how can I say it? The first thing, reparations, or, you know, like if you acknowledge slavery, oh, they're going to ask for something. Oh, it's going to affect our quality of life. Oh, it's going to, you know, it's almost like, you know, I don't know. I'm just happy that, you know, to hear these stories like the 1619 Project and all these other works that are just uncovering things, you know, yeah, I'm just happy to be part of it and to learn, you know, and for everyone to learn, because I think that helps us moving forward.
Tosh, thank you for having us today.
I really appreciate you guys making time in your schedule.
If you want to check out more of our features, be sure to check out wmpg.org.